This is the part of the paper where not only have I started my analysis, but I've surprised you with a reference to an unrelated kind of music.
Yeah.
And made an insightful, logical leap. Are we, what, 8 pages into my paper now?
I hope so.
Still haven't really said much, though.
No, haven't talked about Kurt Cobain's hair once.
Not once.
I'm Nicole.
And I'm Mark.
And this is Never,
Never Mind the Music.
Shut up,
oh,
Mark.
No, I'm trying to do it. Can we harmonize it? Can we harmonize it? Never mind. Never mind. Pick a note.
No.
No? Okay. This is Never Mind the Music. Say it, please. You're better at it.
This is Never Mind the Music.
Yeah. See, the listeners agree.
I'm better at it.
What are we talking about today, Mark?
Shut up. You know what? I had an old boss once that when she used to pick up the phone, she used to pretend to be me so she wouldn't have to, like, talk to her clients.
Whoa.
It really bothered me.
Was this an academic boss?
No.
Okay, good. Did she, like, make fun of you, kind of?
She'd answer the phone and she'd change the octave of her voice to sound more like my voice.
It's not like you have a particularly high voice.
I'm an alto.
I probably should have just spoken normally and it wouldn't have been that different.
Yeah, like I'm a low alto.
What are we talking about today, Mark? That's more like it. Yeah, I don't need to go into the falsetto. All right.
Okay.
Anyways, what are we talking about today, Mark? Indeed, we are finally, I think. Okay.
I'm just like,
listeners
cracking.
I've lost her. This is our last episode of the season, everybody. Well, our last main episode of the season. This podcast is called Never Mind the Music. Did we, Nicole, choose that name as a specific homage to Nirvana's album Nevermind?
No, Mark, we chose this name because it was available to be a podcast.
It was available and it kind of has a pun, kind of, not a pun, but like mind. It has the word mind in it and like it fits. It's kind of a cool name. And it just so happens to also be the name of an album by Nirvana. And do you know that album?
I do. It is an iconic album.
Do you enjoy it?
I do. I like Nirvana quite a bit, actually.
Yeah. So Nirvana's awesome. This is a Nirvana episode. We are talking about Lithium from Nevermind, 1991. I figured when I was choosing what songs we should do a Nirvana song, because even though it wasn't a deliberate homage, everybody's going to think it's a deliberate homage. Mm. And so let's put a Nirvana episode in and why not make it the end of the season?
Sounds great. I'm ready.
Is this one of your favorites by them? Where are you at with Nirvana? They've come up a couple times.
I mean, I like Nirvana quite a bit. There's a lot of reasons that I like Nirvana. Because first, time and place of when they came up is really like pivotal in my development. And I really related to this idea of like teen angst, and the sound was so different for the time. And I just really attached to the spirit of Nirvana. Like Smells Like Teen Spirit is a pretty iconic song for people in our generational cohort. But also I'm just really interested in the story of Nirvana and Kurt Cobain and his struggles with addiction and mental health is really intriguing to me clinically. I also really like Dave Grohl and his like Phoenix from the Ashes vibe when, you know, in his rise from the Foo Fighters.
I think Foo Fighters could be, even though Nirvana is so influential, Foo Fighters is the bigger band.
For
right?
sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And there is no Foo Fighters without Nirvana.
Obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So I feel like it just laid such a good foundation for the Foo Fighters, who I'm a fan of, obviously, in terms of what rock music can be. And I feel like Nirvana was the first like rock band that I really got into. And I've talked in a different episode about the Unplugged album, which was really formative for me. I love stripped down rock music.
Well, you talked about how we kind of missed first draft Nirvana because we were a little too young.
Yeah.
We were like, it's teen angst, but for us, it was preteen.
Sure.
And it's like Unplugged was the one that actually came out while we were listening instead of after. Like, I didn't listen to Nevermind when it came out when I was 8 or 9 years old. No. It was more a few years later.
And
right?
I appreciated it because when I did get to listen to it, I understood Kurt Cobain's struggles and was really curious about that from a psychology standpoint, even though I didn't quantify it that way at that point in my life.
So let me ask you that as we plan. What are you going to talk about? Lithium? Are you going to talk about the song Lithium? Are you going to talk about the music? Are you going to talk about the lyrics of Lithium? Are you going to talk about Nirvana and Kurt Cobain?
I'm going to talk about egos and tonic personality disorders.
Okay, so that sounds, that's a big word.
Yes.
That sounds serious.
Yes, it's serious.
My whole musical blurb has tongue very, very firmly in really ironic cheek.
Okay.
So I think this is one of those that I probably do my thing. And then we go to you because okay. Following up with my tongue firmly fake music major spiel. Great. After you talk about word that I can't pronounce.
Not yet.
Maybe seems disrespectful.
Okay.
So cool.
Sure.
So
cool.
We're both fans of Nirvana, though we, you know, maybe Johnny Come Lately kind of fans in the Unplugged era. And
but that's
since
okay,
then,
right? That's okay. You can be like a posthumous fan.
You know what I love about, oh my God, this sounds terrible. Oh my God.
Just say it.
It's terrible that Kurt Cobain left us so young.
Mm.
He's a member of the 27 Club, right? One of the curse of the 27 Club. So many amazing musicians died.
Jimi Hendrix, Amy Winehouse.
That's right. Died at the age of 27. Not older, not earlier.
So crazy.
But when you're a teenager and you hear there's this super influential band that you just have to hear them, and they have three albums because of the untimely death of the lead vocalist and the primary songwriter, that is then something you can go do.
Yeah.
As opposed to, oh my God, you have to listen to Frank Zappa. It's only 25 albums or whatever.
Right.
Like, there was something when I was young and first getting into music approachable about a band that had such a short run.
That
and as sad as that is, I heard all the Nirvana albums when I was young.
You can like binge it.
You can kind of binge it in the 90s way I would have binged it, right? At that point would have just been with friends, like borrowing the CD or whatever.
Yeah.
But whereas when I think of bands that are extremely influential to me now as a songwriter and stuff, like the Beach Boys or whatever, I have deep dived on Beach Boys. I've still only heard like 10 Beach Boys albums because there's like 30 of them and half of them are called or thought of as kind of bad. No offense, Beach Boys, you guys are great, but you can't kind of experience the influence. Whereas Nirvana, it was easy to go check out Nevermind and then get Bleach and Insecticide
and also
In Utero.
Too, when you talk about Nirvana, we, in the age that we are, we can put ourselves back in that, what it was like to hear, experience it when it came out live, right? Or the first time it came out. We're not really able to access what it was like to hear the Beach Boys' first album when it first came out because we weren't alive at that time and we can't relate to it. But we can like have a nostalgia in now listening to Nirvana that it is a time capsule for us.
Right.
And I think that there's an appeal to that.
Like I remember the cool kid in my whatever grade class that would have been second grade or whatever, who had a cool older brother or sister who told that kid about Nirvana and he was talking about whatever, like way before I would have seen it on
or
MTV
like
or whatever.
Parents clutching their pearls at the Smells Like Teen Spirit music video or something.
Sure. Like, for some reason, it's not.
Well, now by today's standards, it's fine, guys.
It's also just so Gen X-y, and Gen X-iness feels like quaint and nice now. So
it's my chosen generation.
Nihilism is far superior and socially productive to like wrath and hate. So I would think. So okay. So where are you at with Nevermind and with this song Lithium? Like in the oeuvre, we know you like Man Who Sold the World.
Yes.
Check out our cover songs episode, everybody.
I'll say I am a fan of Nirvana, but it's I'm a surface level fan.
Okay.
I am. I don't really know a lot of like the deep cuts. I really just like the vibe and the personal history of it more than anything.
So, but Nevermind has Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yes.
It has Come As You Are, In Bloom, this song. It's not a greatest hits album, but oh my gosh, when you listen to it, like you listen to it and you'll go, oh, I've heard that song.
Yeah,
and it's not even a hit. It's just that you remember it from like hanging out with somebody when you were 15 or whatever, right? Because it was played, they were piping it. And this is one of those things like when we talked about Weezer and just like there's social pressure. All the cool kids liked Pinkerton more than Blue.
Right.
But at the end of the day, Blue's just better, in my opinion. I feel a little bit like that here with Nevermind because I feel kind of guilty. But even revisiting them over the years, you know, the like In Utero is the thinking person's Nirvana album. That's the most experimental. It has some really amazing stuff. But you just can't argue with the songwriting in Nevermind. Like, Come As You Are, this one was actually has always been my favorite Nirvana song. Once again, we're talking about Lithium. It's always been my favorite one. I don't know if it's just so alternative rock. There's something about the fact that the verses are so quiet and then it gets loud in the choruses and there's only one word in the chorus and it's yeah. So we'll, this is another case where the sheet music disagrees with me.
Okay, we don't have to get into that.
But we always do. But this album is just so good, and not to take anything away from the others, but if you surface level knowledge of Nirvana, you have heard Nevermind.
Sure.
Because so many of the songs were culturally significant that you'll listen to it and you'll be like, oh yeah, I've heard 9 of those songs.
So let's listen to Lithium.
Yeah, let's listen to it. So this is the 3rd single from that album, by the way. Only hit number 67 on mainstream top 100, but
this was
not a pop group.
No.
This was so influential in so many ways. It kind of changed the music industry, this album,
like
in a lot of ways.
It's better for their brand to not have like a number one hit. You know when we talked about Paramore and how they made the decision to not put them out on the main label, but
to be
put
on
them
a subsidiary,
like,
indie
label, so it read more like an indie band.
You owe that to the 90s quest for authenticity that Nirvana typifies. And now, I don't want to spoil whatever you want to say about challenges with this band's mental health, but I do think being catapulted to the mainstream did cause a lot of mental stress
on
the members of Nirvana, specifically Kurt Cobain, because of what they wanted to be as sort of countercultural and thrift shop kind of do-it-yourself guys. And then that became cool and trendy and commercial.
Yeah, Kurt Cobain, it's my opinion, always kind of knew he was sick, always knew he had struggles, and broadcasted them in a way that made it available for other people to say, I have struggles too. And I really think that that was ahead of his time. Like now when you think of the current, you know, collegiate generation, like you think of Gen Z, like they're very eager to be what we would call like ego dystonic in terms of their mental health. Like they're anxious and they know they're anxious and they talk about it. And Kurt Cobain was one of the first people in pop culture to like own mental illness in a way that you could really relate to, especially as a teenager. And I think that there's ahead of his time for that. And I think that's admirable.
Sure.
Despite challenges. So.
Wow. So this was number 16 on the mainstream rock charts though. So it was a pretty big hit for just like rock fans. Teen Spirit though, that song only ever hit number 6. So you're right. Wow. There is a badge of honor to not having a number 1 hit, I think. Come As You Are, number 32. In Bloom didn't chart, but the album itself did hit number 1. And I don't understand at all how the album charts work, but that's a good thing, I think, money-wise, when your album is number 1.
Yeah, you want a hit album.
Do you know what this song's about? I don't want to talk much about this, but do you know what this song's supposedly about?
I mean, the easiest, the low-hanging fruit is it's about lithium, like the drug lithium, but it's probably not.
So this is from looking around, you know, genius.com, everybody, take a look. Nirvana's lyrics are famously, do you know how Yesterday by the Beatles, have you heard that? At first, it was scrambled eggs, like Paul McCartney had placeholder lyrics.
Yeah.
I think a fair amount of Nirvana's lyrics are placeholder lyrics that then become permanent lyrics.
Sure.
When you can't think of it, it's just, it sounds good, let's use it. So I think a lot of this maybe doesn't directly mean anything, but apparently it's the religion as the opiate for the masses and lithium as a symbol of religion. And apparently, this is according to Kurt, it's about a man who turns to religion after he's like, I don't know if he's lost his significant other, like it's a breakup or if somebody died, but he's contemplating suicide and like religion saves him. And, you know, there's that line, light my candles in a daze because I found God. But a lot of it just sort of doesn't make sense. But apparently in interviews, that's what he said this is about. But it's like hard to not just assume it's about drugs also, just on a surface level, being a Nirvana song. And that's interesting because so many of these grunge artists or alternative rock, it's like, this and that Alice in Chains song. It sounds like it's about that. It's actually about heroin. No, this song is probably not actually about drugs, but they gave it a name that is a drug, which is wild to me. It's just sort of backwards. Any other general thoughts?
No.
Cool. Let's jump in. Okay. So let me say one preface, and this is why I really wanted to ask, when do we want to talk about your serious stuff?
Yeah.
This is, as a summary of our season one, I am going to present to you essentially a bad music major paper,
okay,
an essay, an argumentative paper I think back to when I would have someone that a professor that'd be like, you're going to listen to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and make an argumentative paper asserting a point about analysis or whatever. Sure. That's what this is. The tongue is very firmly in cheek here, folks. Mm-hmm. I think what I'm about to tell you all is bullshit.
Cool.
However, maybe it's kind of interesting and maybe it's right, but please don't take me too seriously on this.
Okay.
But I got the idea to do this, not just because, oh, it's going to be the last episode of the season. Let's do something over the top for Nirvana. But there's something sort of strange about the melody and chord progression of this song.
Are we going to listen to the song now?
We're going to listen to the song. Here is the verse section of Lithium. I'm so happy because today found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly. That's okay, cause so are you. Classic, really beautiful, kind of haunting, but also weird. Like it uses a bunch of different chords. Some of them are not in the keys. Most of them are. A few of the melody notes are out of the key and really are highlighted even despite being out of key. And it honestly kind of resists conventional analysis, like the way that I would normally bring up a song and say, well, here's a great example of this. This song kind of, that would fall like a brick. That wouldn't really go anywhere. It repeats that chord progression the whole song, but it's so good. And so what I'm going to do is attempt a set theoretical analysis to try to explain what's happening in this song. Don't try this at home.
Okay.
This is once again, fourth semester music theory undergrad who doesn't quite understand everything in the class, but is trying their darndest to write their midterm paper. That's what this is here. I will say this, though. I hope this exercise I'm about to go on here with this beautiful song shows, A, that analysis and deep looking at music is valuable and helpful and interesting, and also that it's really stupid.
Sure.
And that it takes away the fun if you go too far.
It kind of does a little bit.
Okay. I hope this podcast shows that it's worth doing, but that also if you go too far, it starts being stupid, right? And I say that in the most overeducated sense of the word stupid. All right. So set theory. I'm going to embark in what's called set theory, which is a type of music theory that basically names chords and collections of notes that don't have real names, like not B flat major or whatever, right? This song's in D, so we're not talking just naming a D major chord. We're trying to name groups of notes and see how they relate by converting those notes into essentially numbers. So this is a very mathy form of music theory, and it's just a way of giving you language and terminology that doesn't rely on things like what key are we in and what is the function of that chord. It basically lets you focus on intervals and the relationship between notes. Cool?
Cool.
Probably haven't heard of this, right?
No. Well, I do like the idea that learning music can help kids learn math. So this maybe relates to that idea.
Totally.
Yeah.
Do not take your struggling students in second grade math and teach them set theory for music, though.
No.
Not the best path to learn multiplication.
But if your kid's having a hard time with fractions, like teaching them how to play the drums is going to help
rhythm and scales and stuff. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So the deal with set theory as a concept first comes up with this musician, Howard Hansen, and then is later refined by music theory guys like Alan Fort, who, by the way, Alan, your name is spelled Forte.
Yes, say Forte.
Just be Alan Forte. Change your name. That could be your stage name as a music theorist.
It's better for the brand.
It's better for the brand. That's right. Hey, everybody. Mark here, the editor. We didn't define our terms, by the way. The funny part about this is Forte is a musical term that I don't think we've used much on this podcast. It means loud. It comes from the word for strong in Italian. I should probably stop talking. I'm killing the flow. I mean, my initials are mezzo piano.
Wow.
I should own that.
You're not like a mezzo piano.
Mezzo piano is the worst dynamic.
Yeah.
I had my composition teachers, some of them were like, never, ever start a piece of music with mezzo piano.
It's too soft.
Well, no, soft is great. Mezzo piano people means medium soft.
So
what does
dumb.
That mean? Start the piece soft or start the piece loud? Do not start medium. What does that mean? It's relative to what? Anyways. So Alan Forte.
A lot of feelings.
So set theory, that's right. Set theory can be used for any type of music, but it kind of became common for music that didn't have chords. Because why would you use set theory to talk about Mozart or the Beatles when they're using C major chords? Just use the language you already have, right?
Do you like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day, but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come baby come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast.
So this comes out to talk about what we would call atonal music. Have you heard the term atonality before?
I have.
What does that mean?
One tone.
Atonal.
Singular tone.
That would be like monotone.
Oh, atonal. Like, tones that are alike?
Not tonal.
Not
tonal.
Oh, like atypical, but exactly. Atonal. Oh, I see.
So atonal means not in a key.
Oh.
Does not have C major or B minor. It is out. There is no key. Not that it goes out of key. There is no key.
How would you write it in sheet music without a key?
You would not use a key signature. You just write the notes.
Oh, and I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, you just put less.
I went from appalled to completely understanding.
That's right. But who cares about how it's notated? What matters is that you're not hearing like a C major key. It's all notes are treated as equal, right?
Does that bother you?
No, I mean, theoretically, it's a very beautiful concept. It actually like has been thought of as sort of as pitch democracy, that all notes are equal, which is kind of cool. But basically, it's like people started getting bored. This is the end of 1800s. Started getting bored with major and minor. And they started pushing things really far to where they weren't even using keys at all.
Yeah.
And the notes are crunchy and they clash and...
Madness.
Kind of madness. And sometimes it's called the expressionist era of art. Like, do you know that painting, The Scream?
Yes.
Where it's like hyper emotion and madness. Some of this music uses this extreme dissonance to symbolize madness.
Was this around the same time as that movement in visual art?
That's right.
Nice.
Yeah, it's expressionist is what it's called. And a lot of it's German similarly, right? Or Central European.
Yeah, The Scream isn't an expressionist painting or an impressionist painting. Expressionist.
Not impressionist, expressionist. This is after impressionism.
I'm really using my art degree today.
Impressionism is the opposite.
In
the sense that it's not about harshness. It's not the opposite. They have a lot in common, but... Impressionism is like chill sounding impressionist music.
Yeah.
This is often not chill sounding.
Nice.
But hyper emotionality, right?
It.
But anyway, so here's an example of a kind of piece that would have been considered atonal. This is 1909. This is Arnold Schoenberg, who is a German who then immigrated to the US. The piece is called The Book of the Hanging Gardens, and this is number 5. That was my German. Ajet mir auf welchem Pfad.
It is not good.
This is a soprano, Phyllis Brynjolfsson, and Ursula Opens playing the piano. Take a listen.
All right. It sounds a lot like Nirvana.
That's right.
See why you brought it up.
So it is quite beautiful, actually.
It's very beautiful.
But none of those are like major chords. That's not in a key. The notes are sort of random sounding almost on a certain level.
Sure.
And set theory, by using numbers, gives us a way to analyze it and to talk about how those intervals, the notes relate to one another. So that's why this was invented. This was not composed with set theory. Set theory was like invented by later people like Alan Fort. To come up with a way to talk about this music.
You mean Alan Forte.
Alan Forte, that's right. Thank you. So let me explain this as quickly as I can. So the deal is C is 0.
Okay.
C sharp is 1.
Sure.
Half step higher.
Yep.
All the way up. That means we have 12 different options, right?
Already I'm having problems. Like, shouldn't it be 0.5 if it's a half step? And the full step should be 1?
Each number is a semitone, right?
Okay.
Each number is a semitone. So
half step.
If we went 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 7 is G, right?
Sure.
If we keep counting. you want it to be one digit. So when this is written out, technically we go 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way to 11.
Okay.
But 10 and 11 are sometimes written as A and B, which is kind of confusing because those are note names where B is B, but A is B flat. But whatever. Great. We'll call them 10 and 11 here.
We'll call them whatever we want.
The idea is like all Cs are 0.
Okay.
This doesn't care about which octave you're in.
Oh.
A high C and a low C are both 0. Because what we are counting is not the exact note we're hearing, but the pitch class.
Okay.
C is a pitch. Like middle C is a pitch. Cs are a pitch class. So when we're thinking of how the notes all relate to each other, we don't care how low or high they are. Which maybe is a failing of this analysis, because we should care. It matters a lot how high or low a note is.
Yeah.
But to figure out what the notes that are all playing at the same time are in a cluster of pitches in a melody or whatever, we just use these numbers, right? Hmm. All right. You with me so far?
I kind of love it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Listeners, you with me? This is easy to punch into a computer program too, right?
Like 0, 1, 2, 3. If you wanted to like input code into me to play music, like this is what you would do.
That's how it would work. Yeah. That's right. So there's this idiosyncratic way of writing them. Like if you have a C and a D together, that's an O and a 2, a 0 and a 2. And you could put brackets around them, and the type of shape of bracket tells you what kind of set it is.
Oh, that's cool.
And I do not want to get into it, but you get to use not just the parentheses, but the square brackets, and not just those, but the little bracket. Everybody, if
with
you hold shift
points?
With the little points.
Yeah.
I love that bracket.
I love that. You never see that.
You get to use that in set theory, everybody.
Wow. You never use it in just English.
And there's even ones that are like angled, triangle kind of shaped brackets.
Oh, like a carrot. Or the
That's
alligators?
Right. The alligator one.
Yeah.
You can use those too. What are those? Greater than, less than symbols. Yeah.
I'm like, okay. So cute.
So you basically take a bunch of notes. Like if you've got a C and a D and an F, you would convert those into numbers, right? Which would be in this case 0 to 5. And you're going to find a way to write it in a way that takes up the least space possible.
Okay.
So like, for example, if you have a C and a B, those notes are far apart, right? A 0 and an 11. But you would write them backwards so that it was not a C and a B, but a B and a C. Because what difference does it make? It's not an 11, it's a 1. C and B is 0 and 11, right?
Sure.
Which is the same as 11 and 0.
Yes.
0 and 11 are 11 apart, but 11 and 0 are only 1 apart, right?
Okay.
So that set would be 11 or 0 next to each other, right? Uh-huh. But what we name, when we actually name the set, we move it so that its lowest note is 0. So the prime form of that set, 11 and 0, you would call the set a 0, 1.
Okay.
By just moving it so the
You'd
first
call
number
it, but
is
when
0.
You read it on the page.
When you read it on the page, it's
11
and 0.
Is still written on
it
the page.
It stays at 11. But when I'm like naming the chord, like, oh, that's a minor chord.
Yeah.
I call it an 0-1. I don't call it an 11-0 because I want to know that every time you ever have those two notes that are half step apart, you always recognize it as an 0-1. We call that the prime form.
It's like in sign language. When I'm talking about you in sign language, I'll name you and then I'll assign you a location that I point to.
Okay.
So I'll say Mark and I'll spell your name Mark at ASL and then I'll point to like an area on the floor or next to me. And then every time in conversation when I'm referencing you, I'll just point to that spot.
Okay,
sure. Like I've named you and then put you there.
That's right. So
it's kind of the same thing?
Sure, I think so. So in a 0-11... is the same type of pair as an 0-1.
Okay.
So I'm going to say it's an 0-1, but your 0-1 might start on G, and at which point it would be a 7-8.
Sure. Right? I understand, and
love
it's stupid.
Both can be true.
Yes.
Okay, but the point, okay, what's the point of this? So,
I don't know.
And by the way, sometimes it's really hard. You want to scrunch them as small as possible, right? Not 0-11, but there's literally these drawings you make that look like clocks that you use to figure out the best way to put it.
I kind of love that.
I can show you one later. I've got them on. I literally did it for this piece, by the way. That's what we're doing here, folks. So it's stupid, but let me explain to you what the point is. If we have that 0-11, but we realize that what that sounds like is an 0-1. If I ever see an A flat and a G, which is totally different set of notes, or an E flat and a D, totally different set of notes, I can recognize that all of them are 0-1s. And so intervalically, the intervals of them are the same. They are versions of the same thing, right?
Yeah.
If you have a triangle on the left-hand side of your page, and then you move it, have a triangle on the right-hand of your page, you can recognize they are both triangles, right?
Yes.
Even though one of them starts on A flat, the other starts on C, set theory lets us recognize what each one boils down to. Maybe stupid, maybe not. But
why
there it is.
Why?
So
just
this
because
is,
it's applying mathematical theory
because
to
you
music.
Can't because if we just listen to the Book of the Hanging Gardens again, you can't use terms like, oh, now they played C major. Those sure. chords have no name.
Yes. Okay.
It might be what's called the atonal triad, which is okay. like a C and F sharp and a B together, which would be a O. I don't remember the set. I have to do the clock diagram.
Oh, my gosh.
I should remember that. You can't say that's a C major chord, but you don't want to say always it's a C and F sharp and a B. You want to say something like, oh, that set, this set. It's a O 5 6 or O 1 6 or whatever it is. I think
and
it might be an 0 1 6.
Remains consistent.
And an 0 1 6 might come up 50 times in that piece.
Sure.
And it will always mean 0 1 6 in the same
in
way
that
a major
piece.
Chord.
But in a different piece, right. it might mean something else.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So
got it.
I'm not saying it's always great, but I'm saying that's why it's there.
I think it's right? very interesting.
So this is the
here.
Part of the paper.
Okay.
Where I've shown you that I've done the reading. I understand the background information.
Yes.
And I'm generally speaking competent. I have not in this part of the paper. By the way, we're like already 5 pages into the paper, which is a problem since this is just supposed to be a 10-page term paper.
I mean, we're not reading anything other than 3 pages max in my class.
Oh, no,
I don't want to hear
this
it.
This is high level here. But notably, we're 5 pages in and I haven't actually done any analysis of the song. I'm just proving to you that I'm competent. This is a problem.
This is
overly masturbatory. This paper mm-hmm. needs some editing.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to Nirvana. So we have a song that doesn't 100% make sense in normal analysis. I've already said that. Like,
okay.
it's kind of weird. The chords, the melody is kind of weird, but it has some common intervals. So here we go. Set theory. Take a listen again to that verse section.
I'm so happy because today found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly. That's okay. So are you.
I'm going to put aside the I'm so happy.
Okay.
Let's focus on, we'll come back to it. Because today, that feels like the most characteristic, striking part of this tune.
Yeah, it's definitely a repeated motif throughout
That's right.
the song.
The motive, right? We've talked about that in other episodes, right? That because today, those three notes are our main set in this piece. Okay. So we have three notes, B, C sharp, and D. This is another downtune song, by the way. Downtune yep. an entire step.
Wow.
B, C sharp, and D. What are the numbers of B, C sharp, and D?
Because today...
B would be 11.
Yeah.
C sharp would be 1.
Yeah.
And D would be... 3? 2.
2. Good,
I was thinking
yeah.
D flat, so, but D flat is C sharp.
That's right. Correct.
Yes.
Exactly.
So I'm this, getting there.
Because today is 11-1-2.
You label it and then put it aside.
We'll label it. Well, we're going to use it.
Label it and then
you
put it
But
right
you
got to
use the right kind of brackets around it.
Though. Right.
But okay, if we spin that around and make it as small as possible using the fancy clock diagram, which I'm not going to explain how to do.
Okay.
And then we start it on C, on 0, we get its prime form. The prime form of this set is 0-1-3. Which actually sounds... super different from Cuz Today because it's upside down. Cuz Today is actually what we call an inversion of that set, but still it boils down to the same relationship of 0-1-3. Okay?
Okay.
You with me?
I kind of am.
So Alan Fort or Alan Forte, as his PR agent should have had him
right.
do, made a catalog and basically named them all. So this one is Fort number 3-2.
Oh, he even put his name on it.
Because there's only
number.
A few, like, this is what's called cardinality 3, which means it has 3 notes. This is the group of ones with 3 notes. There's some that have 4 notes. There's some that have 5, right?
But why is it 3-2? Why wouldn't it, because there's no 2 in anywhere.
No,
in
it's
there.
Just number 2. Like,
number
he has,
two.
Here's number
okay.
1 for 3s, here's number
oh,
2
sure.
for
okay.
every possible combination,
oh,
each one gets a number. It's
I
arbitrarily.
It.
He named
okay.
it Bob. We could call this Bob, for example. It's just a name.
He named it. Oh, but. He didn't name it Bob. You're just saying
no,
that.
No, no, he might as well have named it Bob.
He might as well
and then there's
named
Tiffany,
it Bob.
Which is
I was like, wait
0-2-4.
A minute, now right. we're getting bored.
That's right. That would be really hilarious if he had just given
what's
it.
What's happening?
But Alan Forte would have done that. Alan Fort numbers.
He's keeping it basic.
Okay, cool. So,
okay, cool.
So once again, this is the prime form. And it all comes from this line.
'Cause today.
And what does it have within it? It has a half step in it. It has a whole step in it. It has the 0-1-3, right? 0-1 is a half step. 1-3 is 2 half steps, which is a whole step. 0-3 is a minor third. Those are the intervals that are built within this.
Sure. I feel happy. 0-1-3. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. I'm so happy. 0-1-3. I love it. Yeah. That's brilliant. So, and you even can write them out, the intervals contained within it, in what's called an interval class vector, which for this
I
one is.
I love vectors.
1-1-1-0-0-0.
Yes.
So if we look back at I'm so happy, which I said, let's ignore. That's a whole step.
Yeah.
Is that the set? No, it's not a part of the set, but this set has within it a whole step. So whole step is now a part of the musical language of this melody.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow is right.
I think it's cool. I think it's really cool. I know that you think I'm being like dismissive or whatever, but I do think it's really fascinating.
Well, let's see. Where does this go, right? There's a reason I chose this song and it's not just to be funny. Take a listen here.
Because it's hilarious.
Here's the
so
next
far.
Three notes. Found My Friends is the same set. It too is an 0-1-3. Right? It's transposed up 10 half steps.
Sure.
It's not the same 0-1-3. It's a totally different part of the melody that uses the same intervallic relationship. A half step and a whole step added together.
Still Bob.
It's still Bob. That's right. The prime form is Bob. Next few words. In my
head. It's the same, but just backwards.
Da 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 da.
It's
same
like
but lower,
yeah.
Right? So this one is the same set. It is an 0-1-3, even though it ends on a totally different. It ends on an A, which is a 9, totally different
because
note.
Because it doesn't. Keys don't matter.
Interestingly, this is the 0-1-3 transposed up 6.
Okay.
Which is halfway exactly through the scale, right? From C all the way to F sharp. Hold that in your brain. Remember that 6. So the whole melody is just a chain of 0-1-3s with that little I'm so happy at the beginning being a whole step, which is sort of contained within it. I'm so happy because today found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly. That's okay because so are you. Book of mirrors. Cool. So why is one of them transposed up 10, one of them transposed up 6, one of them inverted up 2? No idea. And that's why this tool set isn't actually very good for this song, because it doesn't explain the why.
Okay.
But the intervals are all there, right?
Yeah.
And remember that that one goes up 6, which is possibly interesting. We'll see. This melody also uses 9 different separate pitch classes. Okay. How many notes are there in a major scale?
7.
Remember? 7. This is using 9. So it's
what
using
the others.
It's using all of them. Well, I'll get there. It's using every single note in the scale plus 2 additional notes in just a couple measures of music. We have 9 separate pitch classes. It happens to be, by the way, 6, 4, 11, 1, 2, 10, 9, 0, 7. And if we line it up in a row, it sounds like this.
You know what that sounds a lot like is Nirvana's song Lithium.
That's right. Because those are the notes in Lithium.
Nice.
But when you order them together, we have almost every single possible note. There's only 3 notes that haven't been used.
Yeah.
E flat, F, and A flat. 3, 5, and 8. There's an actual other type of music, another atonal type of music, that puts rows of notes, they call them tone rows, that use all 12 pitches, and you won't repeat any of those pitches until you're done with the previous lap. So the whole piece would be like, I'm going to do my tone row and then I'm going to do it again upside down. And then I'm going to have the bass playing it underneath in a different order too.
Mm.
And it's a system to make gnarly atonal music.
I wonder how many graduate students formed a band and were like, let's call it tone row.
Tone row. I don't know. Google it. It's kind of, it doesn't have a lot of splash to it. But
yeah, you're telling
but
me.
This is a piece. This is an example of that kind of music, which this is not. This is Pierre Boulez's piece, Le Marteau sans Maître.
Okay.
How's my French?
Not
Hammer
great.
Without a Master, 1955. This is from the second section, conducted by De La Martinez. This is the group Lontano.
And that is music.
That is music. It is organized sound for artistic value. It can be hard to listen to.
Well, it just feels like a robot. Serial,
it's called serialist music, and it's all about the series, the row. Okay. And it can be hard to listen to. This song doesn't quite have a row, but I think let's take note. It uses 9 notes, but does not use these 3, E flat, F, A flat. We'll see if that matters. This is the part of the paper where not only have I started my analysis, but I've surprised you with a reference to an unrelated kind of music.
Yeah.
And made an insightful, logical leap. Are we, what, 8 pages into my paper now?
I hope so.
Still haven't really said much, though.
No, haven't talked about Kurt Cobain's hair once.
Not once. Okay, we're back to the hook now. Found God. What are the lyrics to that section?
It's oh yeah.
You know what the official songbook, the actual printed published lyrics are in the sheet music? Hey.
Hey. Oh, that's weird.
It definitely does not say hey. That is definitely yeah. We now have 4 notes. Our little motive to be this. 4 notes, not 3. What we get is a 5, a 4, a 2, and 11. And one of those is one of the notes we didn't hear. We get the F now. So now there's only 2 notes we haven't used. And when we reduce it, do you remember our old set, what the prime form of the original set is?
013?
Yeah, this is an 0136.
What?
So what was
twist.
The... Remember when I said that last
you
section
said, remember
was up
the six.
A 6?
Yeah.
So we add a note. Which note do we add? It's the 6, right? Is this meaningful? Maybe not, but I'm writing it in the paper because it's a coincidence,
that,
but it shows that I'm paying attention, right?
Me too. I'm taking notes.
That is a tritone also, which an augmented fourth, which is a very dissonant interval.
Tritone.
Right? And we also, like I said, has that note we didn't get in the verse, that F. So 0136 is fort number 413, catalog number 413. Why am I mentioning this? Well, this melody to me, the yeah sounds totally different. Yeah. Totally different from this. I'm so happy
'cause today it's like a whole shift in tonal row.
But they are musically speaking highly related.
Sure.
We have an 013 that becomes an 0136. Even though they sound totally different, they are in fact very tightly related. And this is the part of the paper where I've started making leaps.
Yeah.
I've provided plenty of evidence, but it's noticeable that I've very much left out the things that contradict my arguments.
Confirmation bias, for sure.
That's right. That's good nod to an earlier episode. Which brings us to the bridge. Mm. This part is going to stress out our analysis just a little bit.
I'm already pretty stressed.
This one uses that high F pitch class 5, which was missing from the verse, over and over again. But the part that breaks my analysis of this is that I can't tell what one of his notes is. So when he sings this, I like it. What note is he singing on it? I like it. Is he singing a C or a C sharp? It's not clear because he's bending his note, like you said. So set theory doesn't allow for blurriness. Set theory has, it must have a number. It cannot be a C and a half. It has to be.
It feels like a C sharp to me. It feels like a sharp note when I listen
to
it.
It's a little unclear. This is either a C sharp, like you said, which makes it an 014, or an 025 with a C sharp. I don't actually totally know. And it doesn't matter, except to note, we started with 013. We have expanded, stretched in the bridge. An 013 becomes an 014, or stretches the middle one too and becomes an 025, right? Those are the prime forms. So we get some kind of expansion on our primary prime form set. All right, so last thing here. The bass solo, one of the my favorite parts of the song.
No one's talking about the Nirvana bassist, and they're very good.
Chris Novoselic, yeah, he does not get a lot of love.
I wonder what he's doing right now.
Well, because he didn't... I don't think people would have been talking about Dave Grohl as much, except the Foo Fighters. But,
right? Yeah, well, even now you listen to this and you're like, wow, the drummer's great.
Yeah, Dave Grohl was big.
Very
upgrade.
Good drummer.
No shade on their first drummer, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
He came on for this album. And
but the bass
he just
player
the
was so
the
cute. Like, I thought he was the cutest one.
Was he? Is he?
Yeah, yeah, kind of. And like, what is he doing now?
I don't know. I should know, but I don't know. So my favorite part of the song, shout out to Chris, is the bass solo little breakdown.
Yeah, so good, man.
I'm just going to highlight just the first three notes. What is it? It's an 0-1-3. This is the part of the paper where I've brought up something from before, the 0-1-3. But as I'm writing it, I realize I probably should have mentioned it earlier, but I don't want to rewrite the whole paper. So I'm just sticking this little nugget about the bass solo here. We're probably page 12 at this point, which is running a little too long, and the professor's getting pretty bored, but we really need to jump into some detail and see how this applies to other songs in the Nirvana catalog.
Yeah.
So that smells like Teen Spirit, of course. Notice how the hello at the beginning is a bunch of O1s. And then with the lights out, it's actually mostly O2s, except for when he says, here we are now, which is yet another O1, but it's transposed. You know what? Never mind. I think this is I'm stretching. Okay, I've now lost the paper completely. Okay, so that was all mostly mumbo jumbo. But if you use it wisely and slightly, you can see how it kind of tells us something about how the different levels of the song interact. The chorus and the bridge, to me, don't feel very related to the verse until you break it down like this. Is this intentional? Did they do this on purpose? I would say hell no.
No.
But it's interesting. All right. End ridiculously overwrought music theory paper.
Really takes the joy out of it.
Really takes the joy out of it. Is that your final answer on it? Takes the joy out of it?
I enjoy it from like a geek perspective because I like finding order in chaos. Like I just like the fact, just generally in psychology, when you start to understand people, you realize we are all a formula and we're all more alike than we are different. And this approach to absorbing music or writing music kind of speaks to that same idea, too. So I'm intrigued by it. And I think I could really hyperfixate on it. And I like coding generally.
Right.
So I would really be into taking music and like coding it in this way. Just because that's how my brain like seeks to put things into pockets. And this does that for me. But it definitely like isn't cool.
Oh, definitely not cool. Now, I will say I was surprised to find the relationship between the verse and the chorus be as tight as I.
Right.
I thought of this idea basically because I recognize the interval relationships within the verse. So I learned something about the chorus that the 0136 is similar.
Yeah.
But beyond that, it's outright forcing it.
I think we all were surprised to learn about that connection.
Right.
Like, did not see that
did
coming.
Did not see that coming. But I think the problem, and this goes for analysis and hindsight is 2020 retrospective looking in any art form.
Yes.
That like, while it might be interesting, like there is a point at which everything starts to look like a nail if all I have is the set theory hammer. Just
right.
Like everything starts to look like a nail if all I have is the regular music theory hammer where I'm like, well, that's actually a secondary dominant. Da, 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 da. And they're like, no, dude, it's just a random chord I chose. It does not have to make sense
and
under your
really,
system.
And it really like reminds me a lot about perspective.
Hmm.
Like you can, anything can look like a nail if you look at it through the right lens, right?
Yeah.
And then that leads me and my wacky brain to nerd out over this idea of solipsism.
Solipsism.
Have you ever heard of this idea of solipsism?
I have definitely heard that word and I have looked up what that word means and forgotten what that word means.
Solipsism is a philosophical mindset, which is, it's a theory that we only exist in our own minds.
Okay.
And that everything that I see in the world around me is just a manifestation of my own mind, that I am the center of the universe. And my ideas are permeating everything, and my ideas like shape the world as I see it.
The the modern version of this is the We All Live in a Simulation? Or no, because you're in control of this, though.
Yeah, it's like kind of like a Matrix-y type of vibe that like only my mind exists.
So you say that to mean like because I am stating these things and looking at these, I'm willing them into existence.
Yes.
Like these connections do exist because I've discovered them.
Yes. Yes. Forte was like, this is what I'm coding this as the Bob chord.
Yeah.
And now that's what it's going to be called because I am the center of it and I've decided. And this idea that if my mind is creating everything and I am in control of everything, what's right and wrong, what's good and bad, like that's up to me to decide.
Right.
Another way that when I took philosophy classes, how this was approached is if you think of a body and a brain, and the body is brain dead, and you give a brain transplant and put a new brain into that body, in that situation, who is the donor and who is the recipient of the transplant? Does the body get a new brain, or does the brain get a new body?
Is it Theseus's ship or whatever? That logical, I don't know if it's Plato or whatever. You know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't. Tell me.
This is similar to that. I think this is Plato or one of those old guys, Aristotle or something. It's Plutarch, everybody. Plutarch. The ship of Theseus, I think it's called, where if you took a ship, a wooden ship, and you removed a plank one at a time and replaced that with a new plank, but then as you were one at a time pulling the planks off the ship, you were building them into a new ship. Mm-hmm. Until you've removed all the original planks from that ship, which of those is the actual ship?
Right.
Because you've duplicated it. The original ship that had continuity that whole time, you never destroyed it. It doesn't have any of its original parts. All of its original parts are now the second ship.
Yeah.
But that second ship didn't exist. So like, it's sort of like that.
It's sort of like that.
The donor organs, right, is the mind or the body or whatever.
What do you think? What do you think, Mark? Do you think in a brain transplant, who's the donor and who's the recipient? Does the body get a new brain or does the brain get a new body?
I mean, you tell me on the neuroscience, but I think the central nervous system, mostly brain and brain stem or whatever, right?
Yep.
And so my initial sort of oversimplified answer would be, okay, whoever has that brain, that is the individual, right?
Yeah.
So like the body taking the brain would become the old person. But I do know that from what I've heard, our understanding of how the body and the mind interact is not that simple. And that the nerves in my sense organs and my hands and all that also are, it's not a switch that, oh, they are not my central nervous system. Like everything is connected in a way that they do represent part of myself also, right?
Well, I mean, I think that if we just say brain, it's too limiting. Like even to say central nervous system, even still, because the peripheral nervous system is what you're talking about. Like the nerves in your hands, the vagal nerve or the vagus nerve that goes from your brain to your gut. It's the biggest nerve in your body. That adds a lot of
information. That's in the spine or something?
It runs like from your brain down the base of your neck, like into to the tip of your stomach.
Okay.
Throughout your intestines and stuff.
Like where's consciousness in that?
Where is consciousness in the brain? Well, I mean, my opinion is that, more than my opinion, but I believe strongly, and a lot of people agree with me, that consciousness lives in the limbic system, and that's where your memories are made, and your emotions come from, and things like that.
Shout out to our first episode
Paramore,
talking about the limbic system.
The limbic system is the best one, is the coolest. I'm fascinated
it's
by
certainly
it.
Certainly top five systems.
I didn't even say top three.
Top three, okay.
I think your endocrine system plays a huge part in your mood, which is of your body more. Those are like your glands and your organs, most your hormonal systems live in your body more than your brain, but it's all interconnected. So like to draw a line between like your brain and your body, it's a very hard thing to do unless you include, if you gave me a transplant of someone's brain, spinal cord, peripheral nervous system, and endocrine system, I would say that those systems receive a new vessel.
Okay. Yeah.
I would say that.
Wild. So the self is in those. Okay. This is fascinating. However, I get the feeling this is not actually what you wanted to talk about
originally.
Well,
it's part of it, right?
Okay.
This idea of your ego, right? And where does the self sit? We are both very ego dystonic people.
Okay, right? Is that two words or
a hyphen
or something?
Ego,
ego dystonic.
Hyphen, dystonic. D-Y-S-T-O-N-I-C.
Cool.
Do you have any guesses of what ego dystonic could mean?
Ego, we talked about ego a little bit many, many, many episodes ago, is like the governor in your brain, right? No. That's
that's a way
super
to think
ego.
Of it.
I thought no, the super ego is like your conscience, right?
Yes, super ego is like the goody two shoes of your brain. Yeah,
The id is the lizard brain or whatever, and the
id's like the wild card,
the rascal.
Yeah, the
and
rascal.
Then the ego is deciding between the two, kind
and,
of right,
and so presenting out to the world.
Ego, yeah. Okay, right. Ego dystonic, DYS.
Yeah.
Makes me think that it's like dysfunction.
Sure.
So it makes me think like if we are if you and I are ego dystonic, it means like we do not aren't quite. No, I bet you're not insulting us both like that. Mm-hmm. I bet it means that we have a peace between the two parts of our.
Yeah, essentially, I would if someone called me ego dystonic, I would take it as a compliment.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Because ego,
you're looking ego dystonic today, Nicole. Like that?
Yeah, no, kind
you're like,
of.
Thank you.
I spent
2 hours in front of the mirror.
I'm probably more ego dystonic than you might be.
All right, what does this mean?
It means that I'm very aware of my flaws.
Oh,
like I know that I am a little bit broken or broken's loaded, but I know that I have moments of anxiety. I know that I have moments of depression. I accept them, and I'm very transparent about it.
Okay.
And
yeah.
And you are too. Like, self-aware.
I have been made to know about my flaws. Some of them I've discovered. Some of them have been told to me over and over again throughout my life, through the years of my life. So shout out to the people who have helped me in that journey.
Idea that like, you know that there, if you went to therapy, you have stuff to talk about as a human, right? Conversely, ego syntonic.
Mm.
Means that there's stuff kind of problematic or maladaptive with how you function, but you don't think anything's wrong with you.
Ooh, I discovered this.
What?
It's like people who have the dark triad manifestations.
Yes. Do you know what the dark triad is?
The dark triad is like narcissism, sociopathic, and something else, right?
It's narcissism, antisocial personality disorder, which is the DSM classification for sociopathy.
What was sociopathy?
Or what is sociopathy?
Right. Okay, yeah.
And then Machiavellianism, which isn't a diagnosable character traits, but it is just a type.
Personality type.
Yes,
so dark triad, because they're like three sort of maladaptive personality
traits.
Yes,
and then that Venn diagram, the people that have all three of them are like tricky bad guys. Yeah.
So
allegedly.
People who have those, even just one, narcissism or whatever, probably they're egocentropic?
Egocentonic.
Egocentonic, because they're like not aware. It's like everybody else is the problem, not them.
Yeah, like we don't often see, you could argue, and I'll argue, that we have lower rates of narcissism clinically because a narcissist isn't going to raise their hand and say, I'm a narcissist. They're not going to be aware.
Oh, meaning like just literally our understanding of how many narcissists there are is undershooting the true number because nobody will self-diagnose that or admit that.
Similarly, how like women are, it's more statistically likely for a woman to present with depression because more women will say, hey, I'm depressed. I need to go get help. And like maybe men aren't as likely to disclose that or go seek therapy for that.
Sorry, you're catching me like laughing as you're saying this serious stuff. I just am reminded of like self-reporting, right?
Yeah.
Have you heard those? I don't know what the numbers are, but you've heard these numbers of like, talk about your sidetracks, everybody. though this isn't, this is the real episode. The average man has had this many sexual partners in their life. The average woman, and like the math doesn't add up, even when you're talking about heteronormative
Just women underreport because society tells them not to be sluts.
Yeah. And so, and men will overreport because society tells them they should be.
Yes.
Right. And it's just like, nobody just, I guess, put it this way. That has been cited to me in the media or whatever as an actual statement of fact without the follow-up sentence of, and we know that's probably impossible among heterosexual people. So why are we even using this data?
Right.
Like
if you said to a narcissist, you're a narcissist, they'd gaslight you and say, no, I'm not a narcissist. Like there's something wrong with you for thinking that way. Right.
Right. Because they wouldn't be a narcissist if they were capable of.
Yes.
So how does this all connect to this song or Nirvana?
Well, what a great question. I'm not quite sure yet.
What part of the paper are we in right now, Nicole?
I'm going to get there.
Okay, all right.
We're in
Let's
my soapbox moment.
Let's do it.
Right. I really was sparked by this. I didn't know what you were going to talk about with this forte situation. But there's a line in the song that I found my friends there in my head. And that really kind of sparked me.
A 1-3-0-1-3,
mm-hmm. as we know it now. Right. That sparked me on this train of solipsism that it is all in our head. that everything we, and then I started thinking about solipsism in terms of pathology and what happens when there's psychopathology that is, you can't address because in your head, nothing's wrong.
Sure.
Right. And that led me to think about narcissists and personality traits and how a lot of times people that have an egocentric personality will view what we call maladaptive behaviors as strengths, right? And say, you know, I don't have a high ego. I'm proud of myself and, sure, you know, and how we reframe things. And that kind of connects to how you're interpreting this song from a theoretical standpoint and reframing it under this completely different motif.
But Kurt Cobain, by all accounts of interviews and stuff, seems to be, firstly, a very empathetic person.
Hugely empathetic.
But also what you're saying, and related to the empathy, I think, is ego dystonic,
yes,
person. Right. That he recognized his challenges.
Yeah.
And was writing songs about them in a lot of cases that relate to the solipsism. There's a lot of fancy pants words. I love how I presented the most complex thing I've ever presented on this podcast in our last episode, but it has the least offensive name ever. Set theory. I'm with you. I'm struggling to like figure out how the solipsism connects to the ego dystonic element. Is it just that the analysis connects to the solipsism, not the composing of the song,
Got but just it. The okay. analysis of the song and the idea of...
We are creating worlds.
We are creating these worlds, yeah, that we live in the world we create for ourselves, and your thoughts do change your world, right? That right. idea, your thoughts change yeah. the world, is a solipsistic thought.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? It is a very egocentric thought. That if I don't feel like I'm depressed, if I don't feel like I'm anxious, then I'm not.
Right.
You need someone else to label these behaviors in you for them to be coded and true.
Wow. Yeah.
So I just think it's really interesting. I'm very interested in egocentric presentations of people that, as an observer, you can see that there's something going on in this person and they have no idea.
As someone who's profoundly unqualified to make a statement like this, it's the end of the season. I'm going to make it anyway. What are they going to do? Unsubscribe?
Right?
No, please don't, because actually probably very soon after this episode airs, season two will start. We're
right.
already cooking
go,
it.
Go check it out.
While you're listening. No, what was I going to say is I would venture to guess that amongst musicians and creative types, there is a fair amount of ego. While there is a lot of empathy and a lot of like real feeling happening in artists, I think egocentricism might be baked in for a lot of musicians, because I think there's this idea of sublimation, right?
Sure.
This idea that I'm feeling this like torment or this sadness or these emotions, and instead of expressing them in a regular way, I'm going to create art,
right?
I'm going to sublimate, I think that's the word, right? And like put it into this painting I've made or this song I've written. And so there might be, I would not be surprised if there's a lot of performers or musicians or painters or whatever that aren't able to really admit their flaws, but they're channeling them into their creative output.
It's like this old trope that like you're the front man of a band and you're the greatest singer of all time and you're like you're the rock star,
right,
but you're not. You're just taking these borrowed ideas and repackaging them in a way that's just recycling other people's ideas and recycling other people's stereotypes of what a rock genius should be. And I think that Kurt Cobain was great because he wasn't doing that. He was reinventing this idea of what a frontman could be in a way that we hadn't really seen in the past, that a frontman can be vulnerable and broken and have a really low ego and feel maybe not self-confident and not pompous. And that's not stereotypically what we saw as a rock and roll frontman until him, from my point of view. We see it throughout a little bit, but he was the first one that really kind of branded that.
Well, and we talked on our covers episode, which was probably came out a while ago, about how that Unplugged performance, like half of it is cover songs.
Yeah.
And not only are they cover songs, but they're cover songs by, in most cases, you know, David Bowie being the notable exception, they're unknown artists.
Yeah.
And he's either saying them by name or even bringing them up on stage and like making it about somebody else in those moments when clearly the whole world was obsessively following Nirvana. And here he is wearing a shirt to a band. Hey, check out the Melvins. Or you guys heard of the Meat Puppets? No, I didn't think so. I'm going to bring them up on stage and literally play three songs from their mid-80s album, too, right? And like, there is a self-awareness I think he has, but then it mixes with this sort of nothing matters Gen X-y sort of flavor that was really evocative for people and authentic.
And authentic in this like sadness and this resignation.
Sure.
Right? That like Kurt Cobain, some people would call him a musical genius. Some people would call him that. And he didn't see himself that way. And I think that that's, I'm going to say refreshing, even though I know his story had such a sad ending. But
I feel like that contributed to him, his depression, is feeling like he was now suddenly viewed as the banner. What's the term? Like the symbol of a generation.
Yeah.
Right. And he was this genius and he probably was. But that then created pressure and created like made it harder for him to be himself and be at peace with himself. And again, this is like we talked about. Taylor Swift comes up in this podcast, but we've also talked about, maybe we weren't ready to do an episode because so many other people have written about it. I think Nirvana is the same way that, like, I'm not saying it. Other people have dove into his psychology so much more detailed than we are here.
For sure. But, and like, let us know. I mean,
yeah, write in, everybody.
Prove us wrong.
I would say just in general, like, write in about from a scale of 9 being amazing, 10 being perfect, how much you think Set Theory applies to Nirvana. And yeah, I don't know.
Just when you do, make sure you use the right parentheses around the numbers.
That's right, the brackets.
Mark's not going to know how to interpret it.
Anything else from you or anything?
I don't know. I can't think of anything funny. It's not that funny what we were talking about today. I laughed a lot, though. Cried a little bit.
That's right. I mean, this is the part of the podcast where we've lost the listeners. We've lost the professors. No. They're all gone.
They're gone.
And we're, instead of, you want to do that conclusion, we've been taught we need to have a conclusion.
No.
But we're just going to not.
You already stopped listening 25 minutes ago, I bet.
Never Mind the Music is hosted by Nicole Vacher and me, Mark Papany. I also produce. Please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and a review.
And let us know what you think on social media. We're Never Music Pod on all the major platforms. You can also send us an email at nevermusicpod@gmail.com. And every so often, we'll do a mailbag episode where we answer all your questions, so please send them in.
Thanks for listening.